So it's really a pleasure to be here, and I would like to thank Zlatko and I guess Guifri for inviting me here to spend the week. So it has been very interesting so far, and I hope, or I'm sure it will continue like that. So in my talk today, I would like to tell you a bit about our endeavor to use entanglement spectroscopy to understand aspects of quantum matter. And so the work I'm going to present today is a preprint which I put out last year, and we're preparing currently with Lars Bonnes, a postdoc of mine, a follow-up publication where we look at some of these aspects in a bit more detail. So the outline of my talk is that in the beginning I will give some kind of a broader but short introduction, which I guess is almost not necessary here at such a place like this, but on entanglement and on entanglement spectra. So what's the use of it? Why is it interesting? And then I will, for the sake of time, I will basically focus on one application, which is to try to understand what entanglement spectrum, so the spectrum of the reduced density matrices of kind of consecutive blocks in one-dimensional chains of quantum many-body systems which sit at the quantum critical point, which can be described by a conformal field theory. And we actually reveal using numerics in different setups that this entanglement spectrum actually tells you something about the structure of fields, of the operator content, of the underlying field theory. And that's something which I think is nice, because it's a tool which basically has been overlooked to some extent, because DMRG and this working with eigenvalues of reduced density matrices is done for like 20 or more years. And it also helps you, for example, it has practical value, because you can access, for example, scaling dimensions of some of the operators by just looking at the entanglement spectrum, which you get basically for free in an MPS type setup. And so these are different setups, and then I will conclude and give an outlook. So in the first part, let us look at the entanglement. And so our broad motivation, I think, of many of us is to study a strongly correlated quantum matter. This can be quantum magnetism or ITC type problems. This can be fraction quantum Hall effect, where the fraction quantum Hall effect is a strongly interacting many-body problem, where the magnetic field and the kinetic energy is kind of quenched, and all that remains is interaction between a partially in a partially filled Landau level, and the interactions are very important there. And another field, especially in Innsbruck where I'm working, is ultra cold atomic gases, where the field underwent a tremendous transition or evolution from the weakly interacting Bose gas case for like 95 and forward to this kind of very nice systems of strongly correlated bosons, fermions, in various lattice setups and so on, and one can study. And so in traditional kind of the condensed matter way, one would look at, say, some of these model Hamiltonians and then calculate wave function. But I mean, our desire is somehow to characterize these states. And typically, what one would do in the past is to calculate ground state wave functions, fine, and then one would look for correlation functions of appropriate operators. You would calculate them, you would test them, whether they were actually exponentially decaying with a short correlation length, whether it would show long range order or would be critical. And that works fine, of course, if you have a working intuition of what kind of operators you have to choose and to look at. And in some models, this is obvious. In some other, it requires some intuition. And sometimes it's really hard to figure out what are the kind of observables you have to look at. And so from that point of view, it actually, from a computational side, it's interesting if there are tools around which you can actually use to study a system and get some kind of a priori information, like is there a phase transition or something, without actually knowing too much before it. I mean, either because this problem is so hard or because you're lazy, whatever. But and so one way kind of the field took is to use some entanglement quantities which are kind of very generous in the sense that they do not depend on very specific operator types, but they will be able to, for example, detect quantum phase transitions actually without knowing, for example, what is the operator or the type of gap which is closing and so on. And to use that, we use reduced density matrices here. So we look at at an environment and the system, and say the full state of the system plus environment is in a pure state. That's encoded in this wave function psi, and the reduced density matrix of the subsystem is given by the trace over the environment of the full wave function. And then one can look at something like the entanglement entropy. And an interesting question is then how this entanglement entropy, which is a number, actually depends on the spatial size of the system. So you can imagine that this is like a lattice model, a quantum lattice model, for example, here in two dimensions. And you might wonder how this entropy, this number, depends on the number of lattice sites or on the perimeter or something else of this system. And so over the years, it has been understood that it depends on the type of wave function, what the kind of the scaling of the entropy in that of that subsystem is. So, for example, if you take a random state, by some measure, you take a random state psi out of your Hilbert space of the compound system, and then you calculate the entropy, then the entropy is typically proportional to the volume of the subsystem. So in terms of kind of lattice sites, it's proportional to the number of lattice sites of kind of local degrees of freedom you have in your system. But then a very important result is that if psi is not an arbitrary, not a random state, but if psi is a ground state of a gapped local Hamiltonian, then this entropy which we measure is actually proportional to the perimeter. And this gives rise to the so-called area law, where area is like the kind of the volume of the dividing surface. And so in 2D, it's the circumference of this circle shown here. And then there are also kind of marginal or deviations from that area law. And for example, it is known that if you have free fermions in any dimensions with an actual Fermi surface, then you get logarithmic violation of the area law, which means it's not just the volume, but it's the perimeter, but the perimeter times a log of some length scale. And also systems which are described at low energy by a conformal field theory in 1+1 dimension, they also have a logarithmic correction beyond the pure area law. And so, for example, if you could then come up with a program where you use the fact that if you have a gapped ground state, you have an actual area law without any logarithmic correction. And if you have a ground state which is, for example, in a CFT state, you actually have log corrections. So you can actually use that as quite a generic tool because it doesn't depend on the precise CFT, but you can use that in order to try to locate a quantum phase transition. And this is just a quick example which we have done, but we were not the first and not the last to do that. So this is a broad literature on exercises like that. But it just illustrates the basic idea, basic point I want to make. So this is a Bose-Hubbard model we're studying. And then we're looking at an entanglement now between a subsystem of a certain number of sites which are aligned with the left boundary. And then we grow that, and we have a fixed given system size large L, which is like a 1,000 sites here in this particular case. And so I don't write down the Hamiltonian because it's not actually important for what I'm saying. So there's some parameter ratio U over J, which we can change. And of course, for the expert, U is the Hubbard interaction of the Bose-Hubbard model, and J is the kinetic energy. So here in a regime where U is large, we're at unit filling. So here we expect the Mott insulator, and at lower U over J, we expect the superfluid, which is a Luttinger liquid and a particular instance of 1+1 dimensional conformal field theory. And therefore, what you can see here is nice and also expected by now, is that if you look at the entanglement entropy as a function of the block size, which is this small L here, then here you see a behavior where at very short block length, your entropy is rising a little bit, and then it's kind of constant for a long time. And that's 1D area law, because once your correlation length has been reached, the area law basically only depends on the two cuts, and this is constant, so it should not depend on how long your block is. That's the 1D area law. And if you go to this value of U over J of 4, then you rise for some longer time, and then it's actually flat again. But then the functional form changes if you go to U over J of 3, 2, or 1, and then we find quite a different shape, which looks a bit like this bell here. And then using this famous Calabrese-Cardi formula for general CFTs, and Guifri has worked on similar forms before, you can actually use this formula for CFTs and use to fit them. And this is the finite size fit formula you can use. And then you get very accurate results for that particular parameter C here, which specifies the central charge of the theory, and you can see that within a few parts in a thousand, this is close to one. And so the basic point is that you're measuring the same entropy for different kind of ground state wave functions, and you can clearly see that in some cases you find an exact kind of a 1D area law without corrections, and in other cases you clearly don't see an area law, but you see some kind of log correction, and you can use this tool somehow to nail down where the phase transition is. And for example, on this slide, this is done with a bit more precision. So a finer grid in U over J, and you can define some kind of incremental entropy quantity, which actually will be proportional to the central charge if you're in a CFT regime. And then you can see that this quantity is basically flat in this in the superfluid region of the 1D Bose-Hubbard model, and it will drop to zero for larger and larger system sizes beyond the quantum phase transition. And so using this simple entropy tool, you can actually locate quantum phase transitions quite nicely. So this shows that using a kind of an unspecific quantity like the entropy, unspecific in the sense that it does not depend that you know that the Green's function of the bosons is the thing going critical or things like that. You don't need to know that, and still you can learn something about at least some aspects of the phase diagram. So that's quite popular in the meantime in this field and is used widely. So then another question, which is beyond the entanglement entropy, is basically what's the overall content of information which is in a reduced density matrix, because so far we just looked at the single entropy. Of course, you can look at other Rennie indices and so on. That's also popular. But in a paper by Lee and Haldane a few years ago, they basically asked whether the eigenvalues of reduced density matrix might actually contain more information than the von Neumann entropy alone. So if you compare to this CFT idea. So the entanglement entropy formula, which we looked at, the important quantity was basically just that there's a central charge. And so for some of you, perhaps you know CFT, and then it's important that a conformal field theory is not only characterized by a central charge. This is a very important quantity, but there is also operator content on a certain number of fields with certain scaling dimension. So there is information in the CFT beyond the central charge. And it would be interesting to basically know in that context whether the reduced density matrix can tell you more than kind of just the central charge if you look perhaps more carefully at the eigenvalues. But to come back to this Lee and Haldane paper, so what they did in order to introduce some notation, so they looked at the reduced density matrix rho A, so that's the same kind of density matrix we looked at before, and the spectrum of that are the eigenvalues lambda. So these are the ones which you sum up and they equal one as a density matrix would be normalized. But then, because of the mathematical structure of density matrices, you can always write the density matrix as the exponential of minus HA, where HA is a Hermitian operator. And if you write it like that, if you take minus the log of the physical eigenvalues of the density matrix lambda, you call these quantities xi in the following, and this is the spectrum of this operator HA, and HA is called an entanglement Hamiltonian. And now, why is that interesting? So what they showed in that paper is that the entanglement Hamiltonian for a specific case, which was a fraction quantum Hall state on a sphere with a bipartition of cutting the sphere in two hemispheres, then could actually show that entanglement levels, so the levels of this entanglement Hamiltonian HA, showed a lot of similarity with the actual physical energy spectrum of a quantum Hall Hamiltonian with a physical open edge. So it was possible by just looking at the entanglement spectrum and the eigenvalues of the logarithm of the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix to learn something about the edge theory, which is very important in fraction quantum Hall states. And so after this paper, a lot of people started working on using this concept of the entanglement Hamiltonian, the entanglement spectrum, in the various contexts and with various tools. And so here this is a very brief and probably incomplete list of tools. So I mean, it started out in fraction quantum Hall states, and it has been extended to other geometries, and it also played an important role for fractional churn insulator studies, and also for so here is a list of other things. So topological insulators were also studied a lot with entanglement spectra tools, the dimer models, Gitaev models, Bose condensate, spin chains, continuous symmetry breaking, and probably are a lot more to add in the meantime. There are also different techniques. So like the initial Haldane Lee paper was by done with exact ionization. It's also the free quadratic fermion boson problems. They're quite kind of pedagogic to learn a lot about entanglement spectra. Then in DMRG, MPS, the entanglement spectrum is almost for free, so that makes it popular also. Because DMRG is really based on truncating density matrix, so the spectrum is always available, so that's quite nice. Also, there are ways to extract it from PEPs, and also we had a paper I'm not going to talk about here today, but where you can calculate the entanglement spectrum using perturbation theory, so there's a way to kind of understand the structure of entanglement spectrum using perturbation theory in some cases. And now, so here the rest I skip, but then let's come now to the main point, which is about the entanglement spectrum in these one-dimensional systems, where we believe that the low-energy theory is described by a conformal field theory. And the question is basically how much information is contained in the entangled entropy or the entanglement spectrum. So that was is an open question to some extent. So the entanglement entropy, as we have seen from this Calabresi-Cardew formula, it has a logarithmic scaling, and it depends only on the central charge, at least the way it is typically used. The only thing people take out is the central charge and not much other things. So there are some kind of subtleties, like if you look at finite size corrections. So in some of these systems, you have oscillations, so the entanglement entropy oscillates due to some, say, 2kF fermionic fluctuations, and they have an algebraic decay, and from the algebraic decay, you can sometimes understand some of the scaling dimensions, but this is a bit more involved, and usually it requires quite a detailed understanding of the case at hand. Then Calabresi and Lefebvre had a paper more or less the same time as Lee and Haldane, and they calculated using some kind of replica trick for all the Reni entropies. Via these Reni entropies, they constructed the density of states of the entanglement spectrum, which is a little bit the coarse-grained version of the entanglement spectrum, so by kind of averaging over a few, so that you really get kind of a density of states. And they could show that the density of states had kind of a universal function, but which only depends on the central charge and on nothing else. So there's no more information. So if you take that at face value, you would say that's kind of a negative result if you would like to have to learn more about entanglement spectrum and hopefully get more information out of the CF, from the CFT, out of the entanglement spectrum. This might sound at first like a negative result, but actually it's not, because it's kind of a smeared out, so it smears out in the end some of the fine structure of the entanglement spectrum. And that's basically where we believe that some information is hidden. So the question was, is that really all? And we believe, based on the numerical results and also some high energy theory people result, which I will quote in the end, that the entanglement spectrum of a single interval in a system described by a conformal field theory is related to the energy spectrum of a conformal field theory with particular boundary conditions. And for people knowing that, like a CFT with particular boundary conditions has an energy spectrum which contains some fields, and it can thus be, in principle, be used to reveal the operator content of the CFT. So now, in order to make at least some of these words making sense for you, in the case you're not an expert or you haven't worked on conformal field theory, let me just summarize the key facts or the key structures we would like to present here, which might show up later in the numerical results. So here are a few books one can look at if you want to learn about conformal field theory. So conformal field theory it has to do with the fact that at classical critical points, or also at quantum critical points, we somehow expect that the systems are not only scale invariants but also conformally invariant. And so that's a richer symmetry group. And actually, in 1 plus 1D or in 2D classical systems, the conformal group is really large and it has a beautiful mathematical structure. And that's basically the reason why a lot of the critical phenomena in 2D are extremely well understood, and there's almost a complete classification. However, in higher dimensions, like in 2 plus 1 dimension or so, then conformal field theories are still available, and one thinks many interesting critical points are described by conformal field theories, but it's just that conformal field theories are much less understood because the symmetry is kind of group is smaller and has less constraining character. And so some of the kind of the universality classes or the typical CFDs which pop up, and it's like the Ising model, or there are multi-critical Ising models. There's a three-state POTS model. There are Luttinger liquids. There are Westomino-Witten models, and the list can be added much more as well. And the basic point is that these conformal field theories are described by the central charge. So that's an important quantity that somehow tells how much kind of degrees of freedom this field theory has. So the central charge is, for example, it shows up as a coefficient of the specific heat, so it somehow tells you how many degree of freedoms you have. But also in detail, the conformal field theory also has an operator content, so there's a certain set of fields. It has an operator product expansion, which has to do with correlation functions, and also specific boundary condition dependence, and some of these issues are actually linked through involved formulas in conformal field theory. But to make this story kind of short, what is important in conformal field theory, what is documented in a lot of these books, is kind of the tower of operators. So there are like fields, primary fields, certain fields, which play an important role at these critical points. And they typically have a scaling dimension of fields. And then they're accompanied by a set of so-called descendants, which are like derivatives of the fields. And so they're usually integer spaced on top of the first scaling dimension. And then you have integer descendants with a particular characteristic degeneracy. So here, just to take the Ising model, which, as many of you know, has C equals a half. So there are three primary fields in that language. There is like the identity field. There is this epsilon field, and there's the sigma field here. They have scaling dimensions a half and 1 over 16 here. And then they have, so this one has a gap. The first descendant only appears at 2. And then you can see that this one is singly degenerate, twofold degenerate, and so on. And this other field has a slightly different degeneracy structure, and the sigma field has yet another structure. But they also differ in their relative location because they have different scaling dimensions. And so the Ising model is a kind of a very simple theory. It only has three fields. But if you look at the three-state POTS model, which is not that far, I mean, it's only a little bit complicated, you see it has much more fields already. So this is all known, kind of these primary fields. And there's scaling dimensions and the degeneracies. So there's some algebraic structure, how you can calculate these degeneracies. But that's just to illustrate to you that the POTS model is already quite a bit richer than the Ising model. And then if you look at the Luttinger liquid, what is a main difference there is, for example, that the Luttinger liquid is not a minimal model, and it actually has an infinite amount of kind of primary fields. So here the set of fields is finite for these two cases, but the Luttinger liquid theory basically has a set of primary fields which lie on an infinite parabola. So here these are these orange, think that these are the fields which we have drawn here, but it continues to infinity, and then it has a particular degeneracy structure with descendants, which is this U1 count, which some of you know from the fraction quantum Hall effect. So it's 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, and so on. And so here that's the structure. And since the Luttinger liquid, in contrast to these minimal models, where kind of all scaling dimensions are fixed and are not able to move, in a Luttinger liquid, you have this Luttinger liquid parameter, which in principle can depend on microscopic parameters. And for given microscopic parameters, there's a given Luttinger liquid parameter. And this basically enters in this kind of tower of operators by the curvature of the parabola. So that's somehow free. So the descendants are equally spaced in this unit system, but the curvature of the parabola, that depends on the Luttinger liquid parameter and might depend on the microscopic parameters of the model you're studying.
Andreas,
yeah?
For the Ising model and the three-state POTS model, you have put the chiral copy.
Yeah, this is just one chirality, yeah.
In that case, is that also one copy? Or?
Yeah, this is also one copy, yeah.
And are you doing this because this is the simplest way of presenting all the data, or?
Yeah, it's already a bit less involved than if you do the chiral.
Right, but yeah. When you will compute the time spectrum, will you get a copy, or?
It's boundary conformal field theory, so to some extent you get only one copy,
okay,
because the two chiralities are kind of glued together. Here, for example, if you look at the open boundary condition or not that case, you actually not only get the parabola in one direction, but actually you get a two-dimensional grid of fields because there are like electric and magnetic charges. So it is only like one sector which is realized in that particular tower I showed you here. And so the reason why these kind of these things are or were already popular in quantum antibody systems before is that it's known that if you look at energy spectra of finite size system, they actually already arrange into conformal towers. Actually, there it's at least if you study them on a periodic line, they are you have left and right going chiralities. You actually combine combinations of left of this one chirality I have shown you and another one, a symmetric one on the other one. So the spectrum is a bit more complicated. But here this is an example from a paper a few years ago where Adrian Feigen and others studied interacting anion chains, and they turned out to be like a tricritical Ising CFT. And what is interesting is that the energy spectrum, so really the Hamiltonian energy spectrum, actually is related. If you rescale energies, take out the non-universal velocity of your problem, then you get structures here of fields and descendants, which are given uniquely by the conformal field theory. So looking at energy spectra is something which can somehow tell you also a lot about the conformal field theory. And within exact diagonalization for this 1D system, this is quite popular, but obviously this is limited in terms of size of systems accessible and also a kind of Hilbert space size of a local site and so on. So you can do quite some nice things, but the number of problems you can study with this very nicely is actually limited in practice. So it would also be nice to actually do that with DMRG, to actually calculate energy towers of states of such conformal field theory system. But although in principle, I think the tools are there to do that in DMRG, it's actually not done a lot. I think there are a few papers calculating a few of the low-lying levels, but if you don't, I think one of the main problems is that kind of it's not so simple to systematically calculate the energy spectrum for a given total momentum. And it seems that this is like in practice a crucial thing that you actually can resolve an energy spectrum in this way and somehow, because the momentum is also important to somehow kind of look at the different chiral sectors and so on. And therefore, again, in DMRG, it's not done a lot to actually calculate the energy spectrum of a quantum critical system and therefore deduce information on the CFT. So now we want to go back and try to see what the entangled spectrum of a quantum critical system looks like and whether it has any resemblance with some of the structure I have shown you from the conformal field theory books. So let us just start with the Bose-Hubbard chain again, basically as a motivation to look at this. So we're looking at the Bose-Hubbard chain. So we have interacting bosons. Again, you need filling on an open chain here in this example. And here I fix the block size of this entanglement setup to be half the system size. So there are L over two sites, contiguous sites here in this one block, and the environment is the complementary part. And then interaction-wise, we're in the superfluid or in the Luttinger liquid phase. And this is now an actual entanglement spectrum drawn from a DMRG simulation of a reasonably large system of a few hundred sites. So what is shown here is that is xi. So this is minus the logarithm of the eigenvalues of reduced density matrix for this entanglement setup. And then furthermore, that might be not familiar to all of you, I mean, in this system, we have particle number conservation. And the total wave function also has a fixed number of particle. And then the reduced density matrix actually inherits the particle number conservation of the full setup. And you can actually classify the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix according to particle number. And then here we chose the convention that it's particle number deviation away from the density you'd expect, like from, in that case, L over 2, since we're at unit filling. So that's just why we can actually somehow put another quantum number label. That's because of particle number conservation in the problem. And so that's how this energy this entanglement spectrum look like. So it's just minus the log of the eigenvalues of some DMRG simulation. And the question is whether this spectrum has anything to do with conformal field theory. And so the first thing we did, perhaps to illustrate that there is actually some perhaps not super obvious structure, is to actually to realize that there is some kind of a parabola here, which is put by this pink line. And now what we do is that to rigidly shift the lowest level at each delta n a, we all shift them down to zero rigidly, and then we do an overall rescaling such that this distance here is just one in some arbitrary scale. So if we do that, then you see that these levels which are encircled here, they have the fixed assigned value 0, and this one has 1. But now you realize that there's some kind of interesting structure in the entanglement spectrum, which was not so obvious in that bare way to plot it. So you can see that apparently the lowest parabola is then followed by a second parabola, which is equally spaced on top of the first one. So that's actually, now that we see it, it's obvious. There's a second parabola, and then there's yet another parabola which is displaced 2 units away, but actually which is also degenerate. So now there are 2 levels, more or less per energy, which appear here. So this is apparently a second parabola which is two distances away. And then you can see at level 3 there are 3. At level 4, with some goodwill, you also agree that these are 5 states which are together because they're still bunched closer than the spread to the next one. But there's some structure here which is not, which might be more than just a coincidence. Okay, and then we do the same thing also for the periodic case, which means now we wrap the open system, we make it a closed ring. We still trace out half of the system, so we know that the entanglement entropy is roughly double, and this also translates somehow then in a denser entanglement spectrum. But interestingly, you see that there is some similar structure. It still has a parabola. It's broader than on the previous slide, but it's still a parabola. And if you do the same exercise as before, you see there's still this structure of unit displaced parabolas with an increasing degeneracy as you move up the kind of the level, and it has some 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 7 structure, and that's something we have seen before. And so the point is basically that I believe that this spectrum which we see in the reduced density matrix is basically the energy spectrum of a boundary conformal field theory. And you see that's basically the picture we have already seen. That's one set of operators which appear in the Luttinger liquid. And so so that's like the interesting news is that the bare entanglement spectrum, which you get in DMRG really easily at no additional cost. You just have to plot or to print and plot these eigenvalues, which are kind of processed anyway. And they actually have some interesting structure. And now if you remember, what I said is that in this Luttinger liquid case, actually the curvature of the parabola expressed in these units of the descendant spacing, which is like a scaling dimension difference by 1, that's actually something which is... Which is an interesting quantity because it's that Luttinger liquid parameter, and it's not so easy to calculate that, or at least you have to do some effort. And now my claim is that if it turned out that this Luttinger liquid parameter, which you measure in the entanglement spectrum, is actually the Luttinger liquid parameter of your kind of of your CFT of your system, then this would be a cheap way to actually determine the Luttinger liquid parameter by just watching and monitoring the entanglement spectrum. And so you can do that, just measure this entanglement, this eta, by taking basically a particular ratio of this small gap here and of that gap here. You can access eta, and then you can do plots like that, where you change u over j here across the mod transition. And so here you get these estimates for eta, and this dashed line is actually a calculation which has been done using some other approach to calculate eta, which is the scaling dimension of the Green's function. And you can see that the entanglement spectrum results, at least away from the phase transition, are very accurate and show also only small finite size effects. And then close to the phase transition, there are some finite size effects, but it seems to be a systematic improvement that if you go to larger system sizes, that the value actually gets closer to the expected result. And so it's actually quite a cheap way to access the Luttinger liquid parameter using just that basically a ratio of 2 numbers in your entanglement spectrum, if this is a Luttinger liquid of that type. And so this insight can then also be used to study spin chains. So in spin chains, the particle number is obviously replaced by the magnetization, but there's a similar conservation of magnetization in the subsystem. And then you can do various exercises. So you can take the spin a half chain in 0 magnetization, change the anisotropy value. You can use this eta x calculation in the gapless range. And then you see by comparing with the exact Bethe-Ansatz results that actually this is also quite accurate. in a large region. Only once you go close to the Heisenberg point, where it's known that you have logarithmic correction, marginal operator, then the quality somehow gets a bit less, and the finite size effects get a bit more pronounced. But overall, it's a very cheap and reasonably accurate method to determine the Luttinger liquid parameter. And here there are some other applications. So here we can take the Heisenberg chain, so data equals one, and put it in a magnetic field. So here we put magnetization on that axis. And then we actually see that comparing with the beta ansatz result is also, as soon as we go away from the Heisenberg point with its logarithmic corrections, we get quite accurate results in the large range of magnetic fields. And here we can also study a non-integrable spin one, so a Haldane chain, a spin one Heisenberg chain, as a function of magnetic field. And so here it's interesting that the Luttinger liquid parameter has a kind of a non-monotonic dependence. And here, actually, I think since there are no logarithmic corrections involved, actually, here I think that the entanglement spectrum is probably more accurate than the old data from that paper where the Luttinger liquid parameter was deduced by calculating Green's function decays in real space. Yes?
I'm a bit confused about the Luttinger parameter. So if there is a CFP attached to that, that's the compactification gradient.
Yeah.
But this Heisenberg chain as spin one, this is supposed to be a gap system.
Yeah, but it's only gapped at kind of at zero. So if you're strictly at zero, then you're in the Haldane phase with the gap. But as soon as you go to a finite magnetization, there's some kind of a Bose condensation of elementary excitation picture, and it becomes a Luttinger liquid basically for all finite magnetization. So as soon as M is strictly larger than zero, you're in a Luttinger liquid phase, and the corresponding Luttinger liquid parameter has this kind of magnetization dependence. It's only strictly at zero m equals zero, you're gapped, you're right, and it's not a conformal system. But as soon as m is finite, you're in a Luttinger liquid.
Thanks.
And now in the next step, we want to have a look at systems beyond Luttinger liquids, or which are different from Luttinger liquids. And so we start with the simplest case we have seen before, the transverse field Ising model. So I didn't write down the Hamiltonian. I guess you're all familiar with it. It's just a competition of Ising interaction, say, in the Z direction and a uniform transverse field in the X direction. And so what I'm plotting here now is now it's including finite size dependence. So what I'm showing here is at the given kind of 1 over logarithm of system size, I plot the entanglement spectrum. So these are the levels at the given system size. So they are shown here. They come also out of a DMRG calculation, although for the transverse field Ising model, you also have other approaches. Since it's basically maps on free fermions, you can also calculate these spectra using other techniques. So this is not bound to DMRG. But anyway, but what we do then is that we kind of anticipate that these first 2 levels, they will be kind of flat. So we kind of renormalize the spectrum to shift the first one to kind of to zero, and the next one we let it, we scale it to one. So that's a hypothesis. But then if you do that, you actually realize that some kind of systematic arrangement of the levels, that they seem to approach levels here. And also that one has a bit more finite size effect, but it's also plausible that this one goes to a value like that. And then also higher up, for example, here you see it's also plausible that here there are 2 states which might go to the same state. And as you go higher up, it gets less evident that these multiplets are forming. You can do the same also for a periodic system. So we do a DMRG simulation of a closed ring and also look at subsystem blocks. And then we see a similar behavior. And the question is again, so these are just kind of slightly rescaled energies of the entanglement Hamiltonian, so logarithms of the reduced density matrix eigenvalues. And the question is again, does this tell us something about the underlying field theory? And now if you take this catalog again of these 3 fields which I presented you of the Ising model, so there are these 2 and the 3rd field. And now you can see if you overlay basically this field with its descendants and gap structure and that one, then actually turns out that this actually perfectly accounts for the observed kind of degeneracy and gap structure. So what is plotted here is 1-1, the gap, 1-1, 1-1, 2, and so on. That's basically assuming that in your entanglement spectrum, you basically see the energy spectra composed of 2 different fields, namely of this 0 and of this 1/2 field. But this 3rd field, 1 over 16, is not visible. And so in that sense, that's that this observation is that the entanglement spectrum of the transverse fieldizing model contains or shows you the structure of fields and their descendants of two out of the three fields, and it's only kind of one chirality. And actually this is kind of back, so the claim is that the entanglement spectrum contains the sum of these two fields, of the zero identity field and this epsilon field. And the operator and this operator content here is actually the same as in the CFT partition function on the strip with free boundaries. So in conformal field theory, you can calculate operator content of partition functions. That's a standard kind of technique people do. And Cardi derived that for the Ising model to look at the strip with free boundaries and look at what is kind of the content of this partition function. And he says this is precisely these two fields. In that sense, there seems to be some correspondence between this partition function on the strip approach from classical statistical mechanics, say, and what we observe in the entanglement spectrum. And then we can go to a case with higher complexity. So we studied a quantum three-state POTS model, which is like a Hamiltonian version of the three-state POTS model, which you can study as a classical system as well. And so here, as I mentioned before, the catalog of fields is much richer. And here, these are the numerical results. So what we did here is, again, shift the lowest one to zero, and then use a scale such that this level here is put to one. And then you can also see that there is a field here coming slightly from below, but which approaches here. And it's actually systematically twofold degenerate. That has to do with the Z3 symmetry of the POTS model, which is a microscopic symmetry also in that Hamiltonian. So here is an entanglement level which is strictly twofold degenerate. Here is another one. And here you can see there's a multiplet of 2 times 2, which is split, but which has nice finite size correction, so that it's plausible that it ends up here. Here it's 1 plus 1, and then higher up, there are also some degeneracy multiplets building up. And if you compare these results here with the catalog, then you realize if you take the sum of the zero field, two copies of the two-third field, and one copy of the field with scaling dimension 3, then this can actually account for the observed entanglement and degeneracy structure of the three-state POTS model. So the claim is that the entanglement spectrum contains the field zero, two copies of the two-third field and one field 3. And interesting, this is again the operator content as in the partition function of the three-state POTS model on a strip with three boundaries. And these results have been derived by Bauer and Saleur and also independently by Cardi. So it seems there is some aspect that the conformal field theory results for some boundary conformal field theory case can actually explain the observation of multiplet structure in the entanglement spectrum. And you can also go to for example, cases which for C larger than 1. So the microscopic model is a spin 1 bilinear biquadratic spin chain. And if you put the bilinear and the biquadratic term in particular ratios, you can actually realize a Westu-Minowitten theory, so-called SU2 level 2, which is like 3 Majoranas, if you wish. So it has central charge C equals 3/2. And so here these are actual results from the DMRG. So these are data points from the DMRG. And here you have a model with SU2 symmetry. So you can classify your eigenstates according to SU2 symmetry as well. And then you can see they also somehow add up building multiplets, which are equally spaced, but with some particular multiplet structure in terms of degeneracies and spin states. And that's so this is now a schematic formula for what we observe. So there is like a singlet as the lowest level, then there's a triplet here, and then there's a singlet, a triplet, and a quintuplet, and so on. And then you can see there's a certain characteristic thing, and you can also express that in terms of SC, and then you get some other degeneracies. But this actually it can also be understood by looking at some combination of an Ising model and of a U1 theory, like of a Luttinger liquid and an Ising model with these two fields, which you already had before. And if you combine them in a particular way, which is very similar to some fraction quantum Hall edge theories, like in the Moore-Reed state, then you can actually explain these kind of degeneracy structures which we observe here in the entanglement spectrum. So this entanglement spectrum tool kind of also works in cases which are for central charge larger than 1, like this C equals 3/2 case. Okay, so this was now the case where we studied kind of finite size systems, and now we would like to study another case, which I guess many of you are familiar with. In recent years, it has become popular not only to study finite size MPS DMRG, but actually to study systems directly in the thermodynamic limit. So where you write down a network of matrix product states, which basically represent directly an infinite system, but you work at a finite bond dimension. So that's what I just said. So in the first part, we're using DMRG on finite systems, but now we're looking at this ITBD, which McGuiffrey came up with, so kind of this IMPS approach, which works directly in the thermodynamic limit. But then the finite bond dimensions introduces a finite correlation length. And so in this paper here, this has been called the finite entanglement scaling regime, because you're in a regime where kind of the long distance behavior is cut off by your finite bond dimensions, whereas the case we have looked at before, this would be called conventionally the finite size scaling regime. So you're looking at wave functions, but in a regime where the bond dimension is so large that kind of cutoff effects due to the bond dimensions are not visible. So that's the finite size scaling regime. And if you're looking at systems which are way longer than the bond dimensions allows, then you're in the finite entanglement scaling regime. And then you can ask whether these observations we had that CFT operator content is visible in the entanglement spectrum, you can ask whether that's also the case in this IMPS or in this entanglement scaling regime. And the answer is yes. And then the question is whether the actual multiplex structures or the operator content, whether it's identical to this finite size DMRG approach. And the answer is that it actually depends. It depends on the setup of the wave functions, and we're going to illustrate that quickly here. So for example, here we compare what I have already shown, which are DMRG results for the transverse field Ising model with open or periodic boundaries didn't matter. But this was this particular case where you had the field 0.5 in your entanglement spectrum. And now these are results which you get if you do ITBD, or broadly speaking, IMPS for the transverse field Ising model tuned to the critical point and using no symmetries. So what you're doing is just optimizing an MPS, an infinite MPS with fixed bond dimension. And here we're plotting 1 over the logarithm of the bond dimension. And we're just calculating the entanglement spectrum that way. And then what is obvious if you look at this, is that the degeneracy, the structure and the degeneracies really do not match what we have observed before. So here the structure was like, there was like one state, but there was a gap. So there was one state missing. There was another sequence of states which were singly degenerate. And that's not at all what you observe. I mean, you can rescale and shift as you want. Here it's kind of equally spaced. And the counting is 1, 1, 1, 2, and so on. So it's different. Yes?
So how did you determine that 1/16?
But that comes later.
Okay. So that's not obvious from that.
No, it's not obvious from that one. but at least the algebraic difference, I think, is obvious. This is not the same as this one. And then we can like look at another example, which is, for example, the POTS model. So this is again a recap of the results we had for finite size system of the POTS model, and this is the IMPS approach, and this is also quite different here. So somehow we have to account and understand why there is a difference. And here there's another example, which is a Luttinger liquid, so this is a Bose-Hubbard model, and now we have different cases. So this is again a recapitulation of the results we observed in finite size DMRG, so this is the same thing we discussed before. But now it actually depends, for example, whether you're doing your IMPS calculation with or without quantum numbers. I mean, the experts among you know that you can do IMPS or these methods implementing quantum numbers even in a thermodynamic limit, or you can also not use the quantum numbers. So if you do IMPS without quantum numbers, you get a spectrum like that. I think you get these red results. That's actual numerics from the IMPS. And that's quite different from what you observe if you just forget the quantum number index here. You've just kind of compressed everything and put on a single line because you didn't put the quantum number as a label. You would actually get a spectrum which would look like that for this particular value, and that does really not correspond to what we observe in the IMPS. However, if you do an IMPS simulation, so fixed bond dimension, but with quantum numbers, so where we impose that all Schmidt values have a quantum number associated to it, so the particle number deviation, we see that we kind of rediscover this parabola and the shifted set of parabola with increasing degeneracy as demonstrated before. So it seems when you do IMPS, the operator content, or at least the picture you get in terms of entanglement spectrum, actually depends whether you use symmetries or you don't use symmetries. And the question is now, is there a way to kind of rationalize that and put that into a consistent picture that you actually understand why we're observing what we observe? And this now has to do with kind of the boundary conformal field theory and the fact that if you're using different symmetries or if you're optimizing MPS networks in the thermodynamic limit, you're actually choosing effectively some kind of boundary conditions of your boundary conformal field theory, and it is known that different boundary conditions in the boundary conformal field theory can give rise to different fields which you observe. And so that's this field called boundary CFT that's precisely about this. And in order to get the feeling of how we can actually change the operator content, we now go back to the finite size DMRG. So we take a finite system and really apply physically different boundary conditions to the open system. For example, we can not do anything like we already did before. So that's a repetition of that case. But we can also, in some cases, put an explicit field. For example, the Ising model put the Z field to break the up-down symmetry. But here, just as one case, we focus on the three-state POTS model, which is even richer. So this is the catalog of what I have shown you before. So these are all fields which you can expect in the POTS theory. And these are now different cases, which I would like to walk through. So the finite size situation is now that we're looking at the system, which is, again, has a certain length, a few hundred sites, up to a few hundred sites. And we're looking at a symmetric bipartition. But now what is new is that actually we do something to the boundary spins. So here, when I label here an alpha, it means that, for example, we choose a magnetic field, choosing one of the three colors of the POTS model or repelling one of them, or which does nothing. So these are like the three typical cases you can actually do. And let us now check in this finite size DMRG what we observe. So, for example, the free case is what we did before. We saw these three different fields where one would apply would occur two times, and that explained the free case. So when we did nothing, so there was no physical field applied, then we had this set of operators. And now, in the next case, we choose a boundary condition which prepares two out of the three colors. So BC means you have color ABC. So we put the magnetic field which prefers two of the colors but repels the third. and then you get an entanglement spectrum which has a different structure. So it's obviously having a different kind of gap structure and degeneracy structure. And it actually turns out that this case corresponds to picking the last two fields. So the field with scaling dimension 1 over 40 and 21 over 40. So that's this. And then the last case is where we choose basically a magnetic field which only pins one color, prefers one color, and kind of repels the other two. That's a different case. And then we get in the finite size result, we basically get this, that's this AA case, so that looks like that. And that corresponds to picking the 1 over 8 and the 13 over 8 field. So if you superpose these two fields, it actually explains the gap and the degeneracy structure observed here. And now what is interesting is that if we now compare with what we had in our IMPS simulations, we did without imposing any symmetries, just doing a standard and simple ITBD simulation of the three-state POTS model, we got this we got this picture here. And now we see that's identical to doing a finite size simulation, but in the regime where we actually explicitly choose one ferromagnetic ground state by hand. And so it seems that if you're doing IMPS for this type of model, what the system does is choosing an MPS that actually has a ferromagnetic moment. So it chooses one of the three colors randomly, but it chooses one of them and puts fluctuation on top of them. But this basically means that your MPS MPS wave function, which has a finite bond dimension. It basically knows about boundary conditions at infinity, and the boundary condition is like choosing one of the three colors. And therefore, it also inherits the entanglement spectrum of these particular boundary conditions. So it's a kind of a bit counterintuitive, because if you're doing IMPS, you're saying you're studying a system in the thermodynamic limit, so somehow there are no boundaries, but still there are some effective boundaries which actually influence the type of MPS or which CFT fields you actually have in your MPS depends on some kind of the boundary conditions at the correlation length level. Yes?
But you agree that the finite bond dimension opens a gap in the system. So effectively you don't have an infinite system.
You have this correlation length, with this kappa exponent.
Is it correct that what you're saying is that the finite bond dimension is equivalent to introducing some relevant perturbation into the Hamiltonian? And which relevant perturbation you are effectively introducing will determine which sector here.
But it also depends on how you set up your MPS.
But what I'm saying is, for instance, for the ISI model, if you don't do anything, the first relevant perturbation you'll have is the 1/16 corresponding to the spin.
That's right, yeah.
But if you force symmetry, then you kill that perturbation by symmetry, because that is anti-symmetric under the Z2 symmetry. So if you enforce the symmetry, that perturbation is killed and you go to the next one.
Yeah.
Is that the picture?
It's not the picture I had in mind, but it might be another way to look at it. Some picture I had in mind, or I think it might also be a bit in some common lore in the literature, that somehow it also seems, you see, there's some kind of common lore that you think that MPS structures somehow have somehow the smallest entanglement for a given kind of energy, or if you want to minimize the entanglement. So what is nice here is that, I mean, we didn't talk about the actual scale, because up to now we always rescaled spectra, so somehow we got rid of the overall scale. But actually, it's there should be some common scale in all these entanglement spectrum for a given system size. And then if you just do kind of a very hand-waving entanglement entropy calculation, I think you all agree that if you have a non-degenerate, like most probable level here, and a sizable gap before the rest, that the entanglement entropy actually in this CFT spectrum is actually lowest, because it has the largest gap, whereas as this spectrum here, where you have two closer levels, and they are also closer than here, they both have like more entanglement. So this is a very heuristic way to do, but it's kind of interesting that you look at the CFT spectrum, and by just looking at there are some conditions on what kind of fields you can actually collect. But given a certain collection of fields, you can just look at them and perhaps guess which one will appear in the MPS, IMPS result, because you can might look at which one is the one which has the lowest entanglement. But that's like an interesting observation.
But there's another thing you can do. So if you look at the wave function MPS, infinite MPS, with the finite bond dimension, it corresponds to a gaps ground state. And actually the order parameter, if you look at expectation values, you'll see that some order parameter which should be zero at the critical point is not zero.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be related to the boundary condition.
You're right. I mean, this is obvious. I mean, it has been observed that if you do this IMPS, for example, for the POTS model here, you choose one state, which means you have some remnant magnetization in the system.
Right.
And that actually kind of acts also as the boundary condition for the CFT spectrum you're observing.
Can you confirm, have you observed that there is this correspondence between?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, and so this basically is a kind of a synthetic slide where we try to put things a bit in perspective. So say if you're studying now a finite size system in the same setup as we studied just on the last slide, with some physical boundary condition alpha imposed at both boundaries symmetrically, then it actually seems, if you want to rationalize our observation, that we can say that the entanglement Hamiltonian, so this HA, is actually kind of proportional to the L0, the dilatation operator of the CFT, but acting on a kind of a system, which is a strip, and which has possibly has two distinct boundary conditions, which we label here alpha and beta. And so the important thing is that in the CFT language, you have partition functions of a partition function on a strip, where you have different, or possibly different boundary conditions alpha and beta on the two sides of the strip. And now the name of the game is basically that the alpha here you can easily change by changing the physical boundary conditions in the chain. So that's the exercise we did just on the last slide, putting different types of field. So you basically choose a different boundary field in the CFT, and that's what you have under control. And the non-trivial observation, or trivial depending on your intuition, is that the beta kind of boundary condition which you have, which is at the entanglement cut, which is a bit harder to control, we just get what we get. It's not so easy to change that one. And it typically turns out that this beta corresponds to free boundary conditions. So CFT experts tell me what free means is kind of not something which is well defined in CFT. It's more also depends on what the microscopic model means. But anyway, in a lot of cases here, we're really able to somehow make this connection between what's written down in the conformal field theory books on C alpha beta for some strip for a certain CFT. And that's really consistent in all the cases we observed with the operator content, which we find in the entanglement spectrum. So it seems that this kind of the recipe to understand or to predict what kind of entanglement you expect spectrum and what kind of fields you expect to appear in this setting. And then these are, I find, nice observations, but it is also there are people also which work here who have thought about these some of these questions in a very different context and actually in any dimensions, or at least one included, but also in higher. So there's this notion that the entanglement spectrum of a half space, which is a bit like dividing our spin chain into two halves, it actually corresponds to looking at the thermal density matrix in Rindler space. Or if you look at the entanglement spectrum of a ball, so if you have conformal field, conformal symmetry, then this corresponds to a thermal density matrix in hyperbolic space. And actually it turns out that these, some people are perhaps not familiar with this concept, but if you actually apply them to one dimension, it basically turns out that what these results tell you is that you get a thermal kind of density matrix, which means energy levels decay exponentially. So if you take the log, you get the back kind of a Hamiltonian spectrum, and it's and this kind of Rindler space or the hyperbolic space, that's just the way to explain that basically what you're observing is not, if you have a subsystem of a physical length L or L over 2, so what the effective length you're observing in the entanglement spectrum or in the entanglement Hamiltonian is not that same L, but it's a logarithm of it. So that's the non-trivial step, which, for example, here, if you take out a segment out of a ring, you have hyperbolic space, and if you actually measure the kind of the length of that interval, it's only the logarithm of the actual length of your interval. So there's a log factor in like the coming in. And then something which I'm interested in, but we don't have to say that much for the moment, is what happens in interacting systems in 2+1 dimensions. So, for example, so that's the entanglement spectrum in this Rindler space. So that, for example, if you have a two-dimensional system, and this is just an illustration of some simple non-interacting fermions. So these are Dirac fermions on the honeycomb lattice. So it's just a half-filled tight binding model on the honeycomb lattice. So we put it on a cylinder, and then you cut it halfway through. So this is just the energy spectrum, and the red bands are the occupied ones, and the blue ones are empty. And then you can look at the entanglement spectrum at the single particle level of it. So I hope it will appear at some point. Yeah. And what is just an interesting observation is that if you look at our the single particle entanglement levels, and you can also construct the many body entanglement spectrum out of this, it actually it shows some interesting kind of a graphical structure. And it actually turns out that the regions away from the soft point, so these are the soft modes, the soft modes are like at 2 pi over 3 here and there. So these are the two Dirac points we have. And these are precisely the location where the entanglement spectrum, if you look at it the same way, also develops some soft spots. And these gaps kind of decrease also logarithmically. So it seems that if you kind of look at this 2D system as a collection of 1D systems, then the 1D CFT aspect somehow reappears, at least in some simplistic form here. And this is also responsible for some kind of violation of the area law, because if you're looking at the system like that and you make the cylinder longer and longer, so the subsystem longer and longer, there's actually a logarithm building up, which is not what you expect for a strict 2D area law. And that's And Roger and colleagues, they looked at the similar model and discussed the impact of these soft spots on the entanglement entropy. And this is just an illustration of the entanglement spectrum underlying the entanglement entropy. And so with this, I would like to conclude. So my point is that the entanglement spectrum allows you to inspect the subset of the CFT operator content based on ground state wave functions alone. And the operator content is the one of the CFT with typically free boundary conditions. And this also has practical value because, for example, it allows us to extract the Luttinger liquid parameter at basically zero cost at reasonable accuracy from the entanglement spectrum, which is really available easily in DMRG or MPS. So that's illustrated for the spin chains here. And then it's also conceptually important, I think, in order to write down perhaps infinite MPS trial wave functions based on conformal field theory. So Ignacio and Hermann Sierra already did things along this way, where heat is infinite actually amounts to infinite bond dimension, not infinite system here, but that tells you a bit what kind of fields you might put into a virtual space in order to write down a wave function of that kind. And then there are also a number of open questions. For example, the finite size corrections are really not understood, so there's nobody who can tell me at least what is the reason and what is the functional form of the finite size corrections, because as you can see, some of the multiplets are severely split. It would be interesting to know whether that actually contains also interesting information about other fields which are not expressed in the towers, but I think that's not known. It's also important to know how general the free boundary conditions at the entanglement cut are. Can this be changed, for example, in strongly correlated models like dimer models or others? One could wonder what the entanglement spectrum is doing in excited states, and also this relation to holography and higher dimensions. It's definitely a very interesting endeavor. And I would also like to thank Lars Bornes, who collaborated with me. He's a postdoc in my group on the second part using this IMPS and these different cases. And this whole project basically arises from discussions with Mark Metlitsky, who kind of pointed me into this direction, and Jerome Dubai, who was an expert. He's an expert on CFT and from whom I learned a lot on this topic. And with this, I would like to thank you for your attention.
So I imagine that when people study boundary CFTs, I mean, they know how the spectrum should change as a function of perturbations that you add, as a function of operators. I'm not sure if you talk about this, but can you benchmark those with perturbations in the microscope component as seen from the shift of the energy level of it?
Yeah, I mean, there is somehow an the strength of the how much you put the perturbation probably induces a new length scale or something new. So like if you put a very small magnetic field, you probably have to go to really long blocks so that you really see it, or there are things like that. So somehow we put really strong perturbations, like we put like an infinite magnetic field or a very strong magnetic field in order to maximize the impact of the boundary conditions. But if you're in an intermediate regime, there might be like nasty crossover regimes where like you're initially doesn't look like you're seeing the boundary condition, and then at long scales you start to see the boundary conditions. So in principle, this is even more complex if you have a boundary condition, a particular one. There might be crossover phenomena and things like that. I think on the entanglement entropy level, things like that have been studied in the past, but the impact on the entanglement spectrum, we didn't look at this systematically.
No, let's thank the speaker again.